I don't want to live that hard. If I was a ghost and it was like, okay, you could inhabit and steal the life of this child or die, I would be like, death, please. Take me to the lake. Take me to the lake. It's you, it's me, it's none of us. Hello, Poppins. I'm Jamie.
And I'm Danny.
And we're the ghouls next door.
Because she talks like that.
And we're in love.
Yeah.
She does talk like that. She talks very,
very high pitched.
Youthful.
Yes.
And she has a slight lisp.
I am Mouse.
Yes. We're the Ghouls Next Door media literacy show from a horror lens, where we explore the real life, historical, and mental influences behind our cinematic fears. And this is our Mike Flanagan series. And we today are talking about his Netflix series, The Haunting of Bly Manor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Definitely not The Haunting of Hill House level. Yeah. Say that.
Not super our favorite sleepy. Of his things. Is it the worst one? No. I don't know. We'll get into that, it's I guess. Not, we'll figure it out.
Yeah.
I don't know if we're ranking them overall.
Yeah. I would say I don't know if we're ranking them because I don't know if we're like if they're exceptionally bad, you know? It's just like some are better than others.
Yeah.
And this one, there's, you know, good reason why we're like
Pieces of it were interesting. Actors did a good job. But
yes, absolutely, flaws. For sure.
It's okay.
And you know, the actor for Peter is great because he went from being someone that we cared so much about in the first in Hill House to absolutely loathing in Bly Manor. So like he was good at turning it up. This is his Brug, you know, his Irish Brug there.
He showed like his capabilities as an actor for sure, because he was just so vastly different than his past character. It was cool to see him do a different thing, even though it did result in us not liking his character.
It was effective.
He did a good job.
I will say Victoria Pardetti is kind of the same. She's a little Nell in this, where she's, you know, like lost little kitten. Who's sad.
She portrays like grief so well in general. Just like, not, I don't want to niche her to have to be one thing always, but every role that she's in that is very grief focused or just very high emotion focused, she does a really good job in.
She could, and you know, I definitely prefer her in You. She's great in You.
Agreed.
But she was great as Nell too. I think she was like, it was pretty young for her. But yeah, and Bly Manor is kind of, I felt like it was a little forgetful. The things that I remember weren't really the main points. And it was that's kind of what made me not love it as much, because it was like, oh, those are the people I cared about. Those are the stories that I wanted to hear. Those are the the places that were like really, you know, tugging at my heartstrings, and they didn't really matter against the backdrop of everything else. And then also, I just really hate, I really hate the flashback episode, like the whole episode that's dedicated to like Viola or whatever. And it has Kate in there. Cause you're like, where is she? You know, she's going to be in here. It's a Flanagan film. He's got to put her in there. And not to say anything about her acting in it. I just like hated that whole episode. It was such a, like a halt when we had been moving and progressing. Like, I think I would have felt differently if maybe some of that was peppered in a little more, instead of just like, you literally stopped us in the middle of action to put us over here into the past. And it's supposed to be this big reveal, but I didn't care. Because none of that felt like it actually mattered. I didn't need to know what she was doing and why she did it to like be hit in the ways that I was with, like, how this ghost was haunting people and harming people in this house.
Yeah, I agree. It would have been better to have it peppered in, like, throughout, because then that they would have been more of a character that we're following. Mm-hmm. And that would have made it more interesting, like, and throughout the entire storyline. And they did end up overlapping with a lot of characters. So, like, it could have been done, like, fairly easily, probably. But I guess they didn't want to have to put just black and white stuff in there to show that it's old randomly. I don't know.
So weird. I mean, and it was, I mean, it was nice to see, like, these ghosts that we were seeing. They were way more overt, those ghosts in the darkness, than in Hill House when they were just, like, back there and you were like, who is that?
Yeah, you really didn't get their stories. You never knew,
which I did not complain about. Mm-hmm. I was like, I don't need to know. The house is haunted. Check.
Yeah.
It just kind of felt like someone told them that they needed that. And so they wrote an entire episode. They're like, let's explain who every single ghost is in one episode. That was so long. And again, it just, the problem is that it halted the progress.
Yeah. Yeah. I did think it was it was interesting to learn about, but I don't know if I needed it to still appreciate what was happening as a whole. So,
Yeah, for sure. Why don't we hop in, because I got some things to say. I don't know if I'm saying anything that hasn't been already said. It came out in 2020, and people had stuff to say about it. It's pretty, like I said, sleepy. So you kind of just sit with it and then experience it. I did like, some of the turns, and like you said, the acting, everyone did a great job. Like Kat and I were just talking about, the boy who plays Miles did such a great job. I could pick up when he was oscillating between these two states of being because of his mannerisms. And it's like, you're a child and you're doing so. Like, this is another one where Flanagan did great with the child casting, and Flora was so sweet. Like, it's perfectly splendid. I was like, oh, sweet little baby angel. So absolutely. I'd say the acting was great. I felt things. And I will say Kate's episode, like when she's trapped in the, like in between in the trunk.
Yeah.
That was really scary.
I was like, not paying attention while you were, I was paying attention, but like similarly, what caught me in that episode, I was like, wow, this is long. And then I got to that part and I was like, oh no, you're right. This is scary. I would be very upset if my loved ones lost me or abandoned me and my ghost in a lake. I would be mad. Or river, whatever it's called. Pond?
Pond. Yeah.
Types of water. Yeah. So yeah, that part of the entire thing, I was like, oh, we could have just had that. And I would have been like, oh God. Yeah, no, I get it. I would be upset too. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so much of her character too is like they painted her as being like strong, like she was persistent and she like refused to die. But I just saw it as selfish. Like so much of it. Like, and I get that. Like, absolutely, you want to live, you want to hold on to life. But you're hurting so many people. And then like the fact that after death, she still like didn't want them to move on. Yeah. Like that's not love, that's control, which is another theme in this.
Yeah.
Which okay, then you did it. Good job. You did the job. So let me tell you about it. So Haunting of Bly Manor is from 2020, and it is about, after an au pair's tragic death, Henry hires a young American nanny to care for his orphan niece and nephew who reside at Bly Manor with the chef Owen, groundskeeper Jamie, and housekeeper Mrs. Gross. It's created by Mike Flanagan. And as I said, like, The Haunting of Bly Manor is a slow burn creeping horror show that critiques classism. There's a lot of class issues. Softly embraces queer love and haunts its audience with tragedy. It's loosely based on Henry James's The Turn of the Screw, and it also references other stories by him, such as The Jolly Coroner and The Romance of Certain Old Clothes, which I was like, I want to read those things. I will say, like, again, you have, like, I haven't read those, so I don't have the same understanding, appreciation as I do with like Hill House or The Fall of the House of Usher, right? Because I'm familiar with those works, but knowing how he approached both of those pieces and like the appreciation of those authors, I feel that it's probably very like close and like inspired by and has the same atmosphere and themes that James would have. So first name, oh no, second name. Two first names, it's scary. Yeah. So the story is told as a ghost story to a group after a wedding service in front of a fireplace. This unnamed woman, played by Gregino, who's often in his film or shows. And yeah, on his shows, even in Gerald's Game. And they, yeah, most of these actors either have been in stuff he's already done or will be
in future things. Yeah.
So she's at this wedding. She's an older woman and she's telling them a ghost story in front of the fireplace. It's very cozy. And so she talks about how this American au pair named Danny Clayton is hired to care for two orphan children, Miles and Flora, at the remote Bly Manor in England. And as Danny settles into her new role, she discovers dark secrets haunting the manor and its inhabitants. The series weaves a complex narrative involving love, loss, and the supernatural, exploring themes of grief and the enduring pact, impact of past traumas, like He Is One to Do. Loves doing that. This one, I will say, it's a different feeling because this isn't a uniform trauma like that we've all experienced from different lenses. It's everyone bringing in their different trauma and then experiencing new trauma. And then like yeah. it's I feel like it's more about how we protect ourselves and how we can also lose ourselves in that battle of like healing or not healing. So during Danny's stay, we learn of the fate of her predecessor, Miss Jessel, and her abusive partner, Peter, who's rumored at this time to have fled away with stolen money. Miss Jessel took her own life, and that's presumably because of the heartbreak of Peter leaving her for money. Danny, along with the other manor staff, which is Hannah Gross, who's the housekeeper, Jamie, who's the gardener, groundskeeper, and Owen, who's the cook, and they all care for the children while being seemingly haunted by the remnants of trauma endured in this house. They think Peter is back for reasons, and he's just like skulking around. Like, there's no, like, why would he do that? Like, that's such a question that I think right out the gate, I'd be like, I don't believe you.
I guess they paint him as like this monster and like,
but he would be gone. I have all that money. You're never seeing me again.
Yeah.
I don't care about you. And Miss Jessel's dead.
Yeah.
But they constantly get phone calls and they assume it's Peter calling because he doesn't know that Miss Jessel is dead. And instead it's actually the uncle of these kids who's calling because there's spoilers of stuff, which is like the least interesting part. We didn't need that. I didn't need that. Like, you didn't have to tarnish the fam, like the parents. I don't know why we had to do that.
Whatever. I don't know either,
man. Like, he was already bad. Like, he's already rich and a jerk.
Yeah.
Like, he already experienced loss, like, and has closed himself off. Like, that's reason enough without adding, like, he's scummy.
Yeah.
I don't know. So The Haunting of Bly Manor combines elements of psychological horror, ghostly apparitions, and intricate character relationships, creating a chilling and emotional tale that explores the haunting nature of love and loss. And I think one of the biggest themes here is like the trials of memory. And it being both like a life preserver, like a raft you can hold on to, but also like an anchor that weighs you down. So where Hill House explored family trauma and grief, Bly Manor is a story about love and memory. Bly Manor addresses the power of memories and how they can trap or free us. The characters are unable to move on with their lives. They're both haunted by their past and present, but also haunting the world around them, not fully present in their lives and unable to move forward. They're as much the ghost in this story as the literal ghosts in the story. Like, all of them are in like this time capsule because they're in this isolated estate where like time isn't real as it is. Like, I would go crazy. Like, it sounds nice for like a month. And I'd be like, we have to go to the store every day. You have to go for a walk.
It's also just like the size of the house is really overwhelming. Like I, from a personal stance, would not want to live in a house that big because I'd always be convinced someone's secretly somewhere. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. I would never feel at ease in a house that large. And yeah. I feel like they probably don't either. Cause like there's so much you just don't know. Like people could just be like in places and you'd have no idea. It's stressful.
Yeah, and people are in places and they don't know. Right? Yeah. And it's like, there's five of us here and none of us belong here. Like, mm-hmm. this is none of our houses. Like, even the kids, this isn't their house, right? This is like yeah. their summer house. But their parents are gone and their uncle yeah. isn't here. So it's like, we're all just like randoms in this house alone, five of us in this giant estate. Mm-hmm. Scary. So this like theme of memory and how it like, it keeps coming up within the show. So like we see it with Owen, whose mother passes away during the show after a long battle with dementia. And this is a battle that haunts Owen, who struggles with reconciling his mother's loss of time and information. Mm-hmm. We see it in Hannah, who through her nonlinear experience of time after death, can't keep a hold of what has really happened and what she is fabricating to stay alive, to like yeah. hold on, right? This is made even more heartbreaking when we consider how Owen just lost someone who'd often forget or misremember him. And now the woman he loves is losing him too.
Yeah.
And it's not really. So, and in the end, when Danny has taken on the presence of Viola Willoughby to protect everyone, she fights for her remaining days to hold on to some semblance of herself, her memories, and her potential future. It's in finally acknowledging the loss of this fight that sends her to her own watery grave early. That like, it's almost like she's experiencing dementia. Like she is losing herself and her mm-hmm. memories and becoming someone new and someone who's violent too, yeah. which is why she takes her own life in a way that like Viola wasn't, was too selfish to do in that situation. You know, like she was yeah. sick and being like, I refuse. And Danny was sick in a different way.
Yeah.
And thought that's how she could help.
Yeah.
Which, disclaimer for all Ghouls listeners, that is not the answer.
Yeah.
Cool. Just the answer she found. So yeah. Most often we actually see it in this idea of tucking away. They use this phrase a lot, mm-hmm. that those who are being possessed do to save themselves. So there's several characters in the show who get possessed by people who've since died but are stuck here at Bly Manor. And when the possessed being is in their body, inhabiting their body, the real person gets tucked away into memories instead of the sunken place. Like they don't have any idea of what's happening with mm-hmm. their body at that time. And so they seek shelter in some history.
Dissociation.
Yes. Yeah. The children get tucked away into their memories with their mother while actively stuck in the past. They can't move towards a future and they can't heal. Mm-hmm. And Flora seems to notice this a lot quicker. Like she knows, like, this isn't real because I'm too old.
Yeah.
Like I'm older than you saw me to be, mm-hmm. Which is such a heartbreaking thing for someone who's so little to have. But she seems pretty aware that like, we can't keep doing this.
Yeah.
This can't be the answer. Like I'm not supposed to have you mm-hmm. past that age. Again, super sad yeah. And well acted. Trauma and memory are often experienced similarly. We tuck ourselves away to protect our minds, but if we don't confront the reality in the now, we can't move forward. And memories can be both a safe haven and a prison in this way. Yeah. Like, I guess Peter does it too, like when he just keeps reliving his trauma. So mm-hmm. his wasn't even like a fail-safe.
Yeah, it's just like more damaging like to him.
Mm-hmm, 'cause it's like, here's what happens. And why you're a little messed up.
Yeah.
Which is not an answer. Not an excuse. It's an explanation. Not an excuse. Yeah. There's also this idea of giving up the ghost of loving. That's a title. Because Bly Manor is also a tale about the difference between love and possession. Like yeah. literally with ghosts, but also possessing people. Like. Mm-hmm. Having ownership of them in a variety of ways, like whether that's love possession, but there's also like the fact that there's like an ownership of your client, like your help from these rich people. Yeah. Like, because that's a background conversation that Peter loves to talk about. Yeah. So, but then it's hard to be like, is it wrong because Peter's saying it and we don't like him?
Yeah.
It is. Both can be true. So characters become so wrapped up in other people that they lose themselves. Every single one of them. Or some of them find themselves in other people.
Yeah.
Like Danny does. So Flanagan in many interviews referenced a quote from David Foster Wallace that says, every love story is a ghost story as inspiration. And in fact, the young woman who is the bride, the beginning and ends and the end caps of the story, says that to what is revealed to be Jamie, Carla Gugino, and says, like, you said it was a ghost story, but that's actually a love story. And I was like,
pieces of it were. We didn't get enough of those pieces, though.
Yeah. So we do see this because Dani, through her growing relationship with Jamie, slowly begins to feel okay in her own skin, accepting her sexuality and her right to be loved. She's so guilt-stricken. And she has to work through her grief and guilt, which is manifested as the ghost of her deceased fiance. Tumbo Flanagan, he's gonna put someone with light, like lights as their eyes. He loves that. Yeah. And that's what her fiance did. And I think the biggest part of that isn't so much that, like, that I think, yes, it's guilt and grief, but I think it's the lack of closure. Mm-hmm. And it was in such a pivotal moment of her life. Like, we don't know if he would have, like, I think his reaction really was like, you're breaking my heart. My whole life I was, you were my everything, and you never told me that it wasn't right, which is like totally fair, right? And it's also fair to understand that, like, Dani didn't know. She thought she could trick herself the whole time, right? Yeah. And so we don't know if he would have come around and he would have learned to love her in a different way, or if they would, like, you know, but she never got that closure. And instead, like, finally coming to the truth of herself is forever coupled with the loss of the person who loved her the most.
Yeah. And it's interesting. It's like, the more I think about it, is like every single romantic relationship in the show has like a sudden abandonment or like a sudden loss. Like, they're not expected really for most of them in any way. Like, it's just suddenly they're there, suddenly they're not. And the trauma of that is very much a part of what's happening.
And that's all, like, sadly often what happens when we lose people. It is unexpected. Like, there are a few of us who get that kind of prolonged time period where we know it's coming, but often we don't. And so and for everyone had that, you're so right. So she was never allowed closure, and her escape to the isolated countryside was her attempt at keeping the darkness at bay. And so lucky for her, it does save her to a degree, right? Hannah, though, whose heart has been broken by her adulterous husband, finds love in the soft, warm Owen and then in children's need for her, right? Miss Jessel, unfortunately, falls for a wolf in wolf's clothing. Peter, who warps his love with possession. Right out the gate, like, the first thing he says to her is he critiques that she has a stain on her shirt. And it's like supposed to be like, oh, he's trying to help her for this job. But the first thing he said to her was a critique.
Yeah.
And he consistently did that. Like, she is so powerful and supposed to be like very smart. And, you know, but this man who's never said, who said maybe a nice thing and it was always backhanded. It's like, it aggravates me, but I get it. That happens.
Yeah.
I've been there. I've been with a wolf in wolf's clothing. I get it. And I'm also very smart. It happens to us, but I can still be mad about it.
Yeah. Right? You're allowed to be mad.
I felt like, similar to how we discussed in our Don't Worry Darling episode, or specifically Kat discussed, love cannot exist in the shadow of possession and control.
Yeah. Right?
We had a whole conversation of like, if you want to control someone's life, you cannot also love them.
Yeah.
Because you have to love them, not something that you're making.
Yeah.
Or something that you're putting upon them. So Peter could never truly love Rebecca. And where Dani was freed from her guilt and trauma through love, Rebecca was condemned to an eternity of it through her love and death at the hands of Peter. Mm-hmm. Which says a lot. Like, yeah. When we look at what characters get to have even kind of love and which characters don't. The series ultimately invites viewers to contemplate the enduring impact of love and the inescapable nature of our memories, emphasizing the bittersweet and often haunting interplay between those two fundamental aspects of the human experience. I also, because it would not be a Ghouls episode without discussing a very big flaw that we had. Yeah. Like, I can't, like, after the tangent I had in Possessor, and I've had in many other pieces of media, and in Don't Worry, Darling, mm-hmm. I would be remiss, right? I cannot go through this episode of Ghouls with my media literacy glasses on and not discuss the glaring flaws in plot regarding the two Black women in the show. Mm-hmm. Right. And though phenomenally acted, right? Like, Tania Miller, love her in anything. She mm-hmm. cannot fail. Like, she walks onto a screen and I'm like, okay, you win. Mm-hmm. I'm on your side. Casting these two women in these specific roles cannot go without some critique.
Yeah.
Right. It's just like, you have to make an, like, we can't have colorblind casting. And I get it. Like, Tania Miller took this role because she was like, I really liked the twist. I liked how beautiful of a person Hannah was. And her mm-hmm. episode five tends to make episode five really traumatic. Really is one of a well-crafted episode in its like non-linear storytelling. It's very heartbreaking. It's a crazy reveal. But, like, did it have to be?
Yeah.
It's upsetting. And again, I have not read The Turn of the Screw. I don't know what happens to people in there. But for a Black woman to play the saving grace of self-serving white aristocracy proves that in regards to the creation of diverse storylines, old habits have yet to die hard. The savior syndrome attitude rehashes the same plot device that disregards the Black individual as deserving of any other arc except to save everyone else, shares Monica Estrella Negra in their article. Hannah Gross remains one of the most compelling yet heartbreaking characters of Bly Manor on Sci-Fi. I found quite a few articles and discussions, people who were like valid in their anger at this. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say like you can't enjoy the show. I think this is a little different than like Possessor. Possessor like really left a bad taste in my mouth immediately. This one, it was like, oh, that's a shadow over this entire experience. But like, I could still care for these characters, and I was really trying.
Yeah.
So in this helpful article by Dr. Francesca Sabandi, titled On Black Women's Trauma and the Haunting of Bly Manor, on her website Margins, she discusses the problems of harming these two women in very specific ways. Whereas Dani and Jamie get months of love to make up their suppressed existence, both Rebecca and Hannah are in relationships marked by loss and tragedy. Sabandi addresses the two women's death at the hands of the titular villain, Peter, saying that Pete, a white man, kills both Hannah and Rebecca is especially jarring given the domestic and intimate partner violence that Black women, including Hannah, face. Somehow, Pete is able to evade accountability and is afforded subplots to do with his experience of childhood abuse, which seem to be intended to invoke sympathy for him and recuperate his character. As we just said, it's an explanation, not an excuse. And Sabandi brings up some interesting points of thought, including the issue of Hannah being the only character who was dead since the moment we met her, which is big spoilers.
Yeah.
When I found that out, I was like, are you kidding me? Like, there was never hope. Yeah. There's never a chance. And I felt robbed. Like, it's a great reveal. I felt robbed. So Sabandi explains, in other words, we can't gloss over that a large part of Hannah's character arc is based on the fact that she has been dead all along, and even in death has continued to honor her promise to care for the two white children of the manor and to create a hospitable environment for everyone who lives there. Even in death, Hannah does not get to stop serving and stop working. Furthermore, when the show finally makes it clear why being dead, that why, despite being dead, Hannah was able to continue to appear alive and interact with the living. The message is that this is simply down to her not facing the reality of her own death. Hannah's denial is what has allegedly made it possible for her to pass as living, or at least existing. Somehow, even in death, Hannah is blamed for her inability to rest. And I also was just thinking, like, there's so many, like, there's hints that something's wrong. Like, she never eats, mm-hmm. and she always has headaches, and she's always just disappearing. And people remark on it, but no one's, like, concerned enough.
Yeah.
No one stops. And that just, like, when they're not even, like, noticed, that hurts me, too.
Yeah.
And at the heart, both of these characters suffer at the hands of white characters who control them or have a hold over them. Hannah, who accepted the love and newfound family with her employer, who is the embodiment of the white savior complex, is killed by the child she cares after. Though inhabited by the man who tried to remind her of her station, her place in the hierarchy, never being one of them. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, oh, we have some tea together and you're one of us. It was really giving us, not us, yeah. Get Out.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, no one even said it. Like, isn't it a little weird? Further, Hannah and Owen's story is background noise, impactful and heartbreaking noise for sure, but noise nonetheless. Yeah. They never get those precious moments of growth and connection that Danny and Jamie got. Owen never even gets to hear from Hannah that she loves him. She's already dead. Right? They never get Paris. And Rebecca, who is written and told to be strong, only to be easily controlled and manipulated by a pathetic and controlling man. Like, they kept undermining her. Mm-hmm. Like, it was like they were telling me without showing me constantly.
Yeah.
Which is so weird. Tumblr user Fun Fatale remarks on all these injustices and more when asked, how is Black Manor racist? Including a super valid point about the women's deaths, saying, Hannah and Rebecca both have super traumatic deaths. Rebecca trusts Peter and he literally walks her body into the lake so he won't be alone, and she continues to talk to him. Hannah gets pushed down a well by a possessed child and cracks her head open. Like, what the fuck? Compare that to Charlotte, this is the children's mom, who dies off screen while trying to fix her marriage. Or to Danny, mm-hmm. who gets to have a whole fucking decade with Jamie, where she lives and loves and gets married and travels. Danny and Jamie get to have a life together. And yes, it's cut short, but Danny gets far more life and agency than Hannah or Rebecca ever did, both of whom don't expect their deaths and die more or less alone.
Yeah.
And they're forgotten. Like, both of them don't... Lastly, perhaps most heartbreaking, is that Hannah is forgotten, right? I think back to Possessor and the pain I felt watching a woman's history be written over and promptly forgotten. In the end, it is seen as a good thing that the two children have forgotten their time at Bly Manor, but more importantly, forgotten Hannah entirely. They know someone cared for them, but never who she was. They've forgotten. They're just like, oh, some woman took care of us,
mm-hmm.
right? Her, a woman who found this family and fought it to be her own, right? Who sacrificed her life to save everyone, is forgotten, and that's supposed to be a good thing.
Yeah.
Just, and Owen's just alone. Like, they stop in to be like, oh, let's reminisce and be sad about her. But he's alone all the time.
Yeah.
To miss her and never be, like, his love is eternal. He's never going to not have her in it. But then he dies. And that's it, right? Mm-hmm. In the end, we're left with a lackluster show that pushes terrible tropes to the forefront. Except, like, examples are Kill Your Gays and The Black Woman Servant, right? Because Give and Get Out. And as much as I loved the exploration of grief in Hill House, I'm terribly disappointed by this show and its lack of consideration. I couldn't even love the brief moments between Danny and Jamie when they rested in the shadows and on the shoulders of Hannah and Rebecca's pain. If love is a ghost story, this one needed to be exercised. That's me. That's mine.
Yeah.
Like, and again, no. I enjoyed the show. I've watched it twice now. There are moments I enjoy. Yeah.
Yeah, I tried twice in the show, and it was only literally when it was like Hannah and Owen specifically. Mm-hmm. Like, it ruined me a little bit that they just didn't get to have their time. Like, they never got to have those moments. They didn't get to have their story. And that when she was forgotten, I think that was the second time I did. And I was just like, that's not fair. It's not right. So
I'm like, why her?
Yeah.
You know?
And like, you can forget the trauma, but you still remember the people, you know? It's.
Mm-hmm. Jessel gave her perfectly splendid. Mm-hmm. That's foundational. Like, that person came in and like changed their lives.
Yeah.
Poor babies. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I'm not going to be talking about the show so much as I'm going to be talking about like kind of like what the theme was, which is for me, it was a big thing. Was the exploration of people living in people's memories, in stories, and the things that they owned. That after death, as the show says a lot, Cave said, we are tucked away into memories of those we loved and only retain who we are for as long as we are remembered. That time takes us with it, and all that is left is a whisper down the lane of stories of who we were that can be misunderstood or misremembered. Or like, in like misunderstood, misremembered, it can be in good ways or bad ways. It really depends on who you have to say them. So in my section, I'll be unpacking why humans want to be remembered, how many approach being remembered, and the ways legacy can be misunderstood with time. So I read a few articles specifically on like the anthropology reasons, study of humanity reasons why we want to be remembered within our cultures. And in an article titled The Desire to be Remembered, a Review and Analysis of Legacy, Motivations, and Behavior on Science Direct, and another titled Five Reasons We Want to be Remembered on Psychology Today, they outline five reasons as humans we may feel like compelled both through a want and a need to be remembered. The first reason is the need to be loved and to belong. This is something that's like really pivotal in the human experience, both in life and in death. Like, generally, people just really want connection with others. We're generally social creatures. So as people generally seek out community and social connections in life, they do so mutually in theory and death, and the want to maintain this connection extends past the existence of us. So they say that the scientists point out that for some people, the wish to be remembered positively after death may simply be a psychological artifact of a strong wish to be liked by others while still alive. That our desire for connection and energy, that our desire for connection and the energy and emotion that went into that transcend our lives. So, all the people we meet, we want them to remember us. And we want to have enough connections and friends and family and people to know who we were for however long that may be. The second reason is making life better for their children or grandchildren. Generally, the idea here is to be remembered positively or negatively both have consequences after our passing. Someone who lived a life that was notoriously harmful or even misunderstood can negatively impact the relatives that continue living after the death of that family member. And that the community impacted by this person or by the rumor of their impact, like what gets written about them, what kind of like historical things end up being found and like misconstrued, can affect how the community as a whole views the surviving family members. So like, for they give live an example, like if you had a family member who was like a notorious criminal and was taken down, like was arrested for their crimes or whatever, the children and family members of that criminal may receive hatred from the people who are impacted by them, or even just like the rumors of that reality, like children get bullied for it, stuff like that. And then inversely, if you had like a profound positive impact on a community, that that can positively impact your family's thinking more like generational wealth or like generational like community members, like people like who get like a bench named after them, stuff like that, you know. And this goes as well with like generational poverty. Like, we're whatever you leave behind is going to impact the generations that follow you, whether that's good or bad. Number three was fighting death anxiety. Essentially, like, people don't want to die, and that's reasonable. People feel a lot of anxiousness about that. And something we see at the end of the show, which stood out to me, was the, like the wife, the one about to get married, was like crying. She's like, I think about all the time what it would be like to lose that person. Mm-hmm. And then you have Jamie's character be like, that's inevitable. You just have to take everything day by day and enjoy them while you have them. And that's like a truth about life. So a lot of people feel a lot of death anxiety because they're scared of the possibility of loss. And this is increased even more when you have someone like you've already experienced loss, that it's more in the forefront of your mind. So as a way for fighting death anxiety, the idea of securing a legacy or preparing for one's inevitable death can alleviate this anxiety, as well as like some people do this through religious or spiritual beliefs, and others do it through monetary or symbolic methods. So they say leaving a legacy similarly could help fight off death anxiety by granting a sense of what scientists call symbolic immortality. So by leaving behind something of great value, people create a memory that outlives themselves and gives them a feeling that their existence has mattered. And it all just stems from the desire to have your life mean something, and that that is more of like an individual's perception of what's happening. Mm-hmm. And then some people hold value in different things. But books like The Five People You Meet in Heaven, I remember that was like really impactful to me when I was in high school and I read that, speak to this and the human's desire to know the meaning and purpose of their life, and that they need there to be one, that they need, if they're not remembered, they need their life to matter for something. So the, for example, like The Five People You Meet in Heaven, the whole thing there is that like, you impact people in ways you don't even know, that you don't even have knowledge of. So that kind of stacks and has impact on people who you have no idea you did that with in a positive way. So like you could have just like pushed your cart back to where it was supposed to go at the grocery store, and unknowingly to you 20 minutes later, that saved someone from getting hit by a car, you know, like stuff like that. Like you just don't know the impact of your life. So the idea of like that, in death, you'll get some sort of purpose, or you'll get some sort of knowledge of what it all was for. It's something that can grant people peace, essentially. Telling a story is another one. Another reason for the wish to be remembered after death that is identified by scientists is the wish to tell one's personal story to future generations. People often see themselves as their protagonist of their life story. We forget that other people have their own protagonist feelings, you know what I mean? Like everyone thinks they're the protagonist. So similar to a leading actor or actress in a movie, we all kind of think that we're the hero of the story. Not everyone, but like lots of people. Enough that they made science about it. So this life story develops over the years and helps people in understanding significant life events and challenges, kind of tying back to like, you just want your life to mean something and you want people to know that it meant something. So essentially in psychoanalysis, there is a concept of generativity, which is the wish to guide future generations as well. The scientists point out that generativity may also be a major reason why people want to be remembered. So for example, writing a biography, giving a moral or advice-based lesson for future generations gives the idea of you're having a lasting positive impact. You've changed the world in some way and someone will know you were here. So and the last one is making it easier to imagine the future. Essentially, people don't know what a future without them would look like. There's like animes and stuff made about this, like Yu Yu Hakusho. The whole thing is that he's like, no one would miss me, and then he finds out people would definitely miss him, and he's like, whoa. And there's like so many, not even just animes, there's a lot of animes where you get isekai and you're that, or just like stories in general where that takes place. What is that one? It's like a Christmas movie. And he thinks he doesn't matter, and then he dies.
It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, It's a Wonderful Life. There's like so much media that revolves around that idea that like people just don't know what it would be
Christmas
like.
Christmas Carol.
Yeah, exactly. So people don't know what it's, can't imagine a future with them not in it anymore. And death results in a permanent absence of consciousness. So no matter what someone experiences, their absence of consciousness is really hard to understand. So by leaving a legacy behind, you're ensuring that people remember them forever, consciously. And it may be easier for people to imagine a future with which they're at least remembered so that they still exist in some way. So in another article that was pretty depressing, I'm going to preface that it's a depressing article because the title is, you will likely be forgotten soon after you die. ow, on Medium, they discuss the length of time a person is on average remembered when they haven't been granted the power or privilege that many well-known people are. On average, it is said that it takes 2 or 3 generations for someone to fade entirely from the familial or public memory unless they are recorded in some sort of history book or taught about in some way. That's why a lot of people, like, in their grieving process, like, I know for my own, like, personal journey with that is, like, a lot of my creative stuff has the people that I've lost in it, mm-hmm. in the hopes that if someone reads that, someone else knew them. You know what I mean? It keeps mm-hmm. them alive in some way. So the same idea is here, that without some sort of legacy to leave behind, if they were not successful in that, sometimes people think like the children of that person's duty is to preserve that legacy. Or sometimes it's just a personal feeling. So, yeah, on average, it says it's 2 to 3 generations. And the article describes this passing of time and the exit from memory as a second death. We see this a bit in Bly Manor in that even if the spirits continue on at Bly, their faces, their motivations, and who they really were fade from memory. All that remains is the energy that they left behind, like the impact of their actions. That mm-hmm. are all kind of like obscured. Like, we don't know the whys unless we're told, which we do get in the show, but like a lot of them for like the bulk of the show until we get to like episode, I think like the last, before the last one,
mm-hmm.
Where you're just like, wow, what's happening? Mm-hmm. Why this ghost so mad? You know, why they murdering everybody? So yeah, you get like the continuation of the impact of that person, the harm that they caused or whatever, but you don't get them anymore. You don't really get like who they were as a person. So they continue on to say, it's worth noting that some people may be remembered for their contributions or impact on the world, such as historical figures, leaders, or people who have made significant contributions in their field. But for the vast majority of people, they will be remembered by only a small circle of family and close friends for a finite period of time before they too pass on and are forgotten. That, wow, this is depressing. that's me. That's me saying that part. Wow, that is depressing. It can be recognized that when people either exist socially, continue to make art, write, make science, some other kind of creative field, they're all likely to be remembered in the subsections of those communities longer than within just the family structure. So like, if anything, it's like motivation, like, go write some stuff, write a diary. Because, you know, sometimes diaries get picked up as historical evidence of what that time period was like. So things that can be left behind and found by later generations lead to a legacy being maintained, although sometimes misunderstood with the passage of time. So from a historiography standpoint, keeping writings from a lost loved one can be the really great way to preserve their consciousness without them here, seeing their handwriting, reading their words, seeing the way that they saw the world. So it's like anything that they created. Keeping those things is like a way to preserve that kind of memory of them. And from a history standpoint, hundreds of years from now, they could find that thing and be like, humans during this time did this. And you might not have your name there, but somebody remembers you, even if it's in this obscured way. Mm-hmm. So even the mundane could be studied by future historians to get a better understanding of what the world was like while we were alive. In another article titled, How to Stay Famous After You Die, AI scientists have an answer from Forbes. It's kind of silly, but they discuss a study titled Postmortem Memory of Public Figures in the News and Social Media, and it was conducted by Robert Ress, Jure Leskovec, and Christopher Potts. And the study analyzes how people are remembered in news and social media before and after their death, focusing on trends and factors influencing postmortem memory. The researchers essentially found that an unnatural death of a young public figure resulted in the longest lasting memory, with a significant spike in media attention immediately after death. Artists tend to have a more enduring legacy compared to leaders or athletes, whose significance decreases once they cannot replicate their actions. So like art, you can't make the same art unless you're making copies. You know what I mean? Like a lot of artists get not respected in their a lifetime, but are respected and retroactively.
Mm-hmm.
So the study also notes that Twitter users pay less attention to the deaths of older public figures or leaders, and that finally it suggests that avoiding premature death and living longer could increase the chances of becoming famous later in life, if that matters to you, and thus the likelihood of being remembered.
Avoid premature death. Sure.
Yeah, like, try really hard.
What am I doing regular that's not avoiding that? Like, what can I do to do that? What's the answer?
And also, like, what things do you have no control over, like, from a class or governmental standpoint?
Just get famous.
Make
about
that harder. So, in another article that I'm going to kind of leave my section on, maybe we can talk about the question they posed because I thought it was pretty interesting. Is in an article that I only was able to read part of because paywalls suck. But it poses an interesting question, and it was called "The Desire for Legacy is a Mental Glitch, but We Can Use It for Good" from New Scientist. And in this article, they provide two scenarios. So I'm going to ask you, Gabe, which you'd prefer.
Okay.
And I'll say which I prefer too. So in the first scenario, you have lived a life filled with love and meaning and enough money to get by comfortably. However, after you die, something terrible is revealed about you, which may or may not be true. And people will come to despise you. Scenario one. In the second scenario, you have a life of relative hardship and obscurity. But after you die, it is revealed that you were an incredibly talented artist and your reputation is assured forever. Which option would you choose?
This is like the worst would you rather. Because this is like the possessor thing, where it's like she lived that whole time and now she's going to be remembered as like this monster.
Yeah.
Or like, I don't care if I'm obscure and I live in relative hardship as it is. I think what it is I don't care if after my death I would be incredibly like revealed as incredibly talented artist. This is essentially that episode of Doctor Who that everyone loves where he finds Van Gogh and he's hella depressed because that's what he was.
Yeah.
The most depressed because no one cared. No one gave a fuck about his work. And so he brings him to the future where his art is in a museum and it makes him cry. And I was like, good fucking help that was. Like, he's still dead. Like, like, does he remember this? He's not, because he died. You can't change what he was feeling and what happened to him that led to his death, because you're changing like history. So I would rather like be forgotten than be remembered for something terrible, like have my history rewritten.
Yeah.
You know, so I'd rather be forgotten. If that's an option, that's a secret third option that I've invented.
Yeah. I don't think if I'm not around to have to deal with the perception of me, it doesn't really bother me if people were like, wow, they sucked. Cause it's like, I know I don't suck, you know?
Yeah. But we just talked about how it also impacts your family and community.
That's fair. That's fair.
So it's like, you're not here, but the people you leave behind are here. And now they have to reconsider their entire understanding of you.
Yeah.
And your like existence with them.
Yeah. So that's what makes it hard. Cause it's like, you do have like the better life realistically, in the first version. But you're perceived by others better. In the second version, I think there should be, as you said, like a secret third option where it's like, I'm either, I have like a good life, but I'm just forgotten and that's chill.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah. And I think like the idea of the only reason it wouldn't be the first one for me is because of what you just said. Like, I wouldn't want that to harm the people that I love. Other than that though, like, I don't care what people think. I'm trying to work on not caring what people think. Yeah. I actually deeply care what people think. But I'm trying to not do that. That's part of like the unmasking and the healing that I'm trying to do. I want to not care, you know? I just don't want that to bother me, because why should it if the people around me love me, you know? Mm-hmm. So ultimately, I agree with you that there should be a secret third option. But probably if I had to, I guess, pick the second one.
Yeah, I guess if I had to, I would pick the second one.
Yeah.
like, because does it, it's like, there's a big question too. It's like, okay, it says you live this lovely life, but did you? Like, mm-hmm. now you didn't. I don't know. I just think we are more than now. Like, we are more than just us. Like, we aren't the main character of the story, right? We are a character in the rich tapestry of history in the world, right? We are the interactions with other people and the impacts of other people, right? Everything you touch, you change, Toni Morrison says. So everything I touch, I changed. And then it's revealed that those touches were sinister and now are,
well, they said it could not be true, it could be made up, it could just be a rumor. Yeah,
but the but belief is so much stronger than reality. We live in America. So I feel like it's just like a whole conversation of like the fact that like it is such a like life, like people say life is short, but it's the longest thing that you ever do, right? But it's short in the way that like the parts that we live of it are short, because we just, even if we're going to be gone in a few generations, like even if we're going to be forgotten in three generations, we were remembered for three more generations than we were alive. So we were, we lived like in this abstract form longer than we lived in this form. And so like, I don't know, I'm getting like, unpacking this, but yeah, I just feel like our impact on the world around us and the people around us is really heavy, and it's, I think it's it's something that's beautiful and also scary, and I think that's why like the idea of them sabotaging your legacy in any way is like incredibly harmful, like more harmful than being forgotten, I think. So I picked the second one. Fine, I'll be a famous artist, whatever.
Yeah, and I think it's like they really like trip you up with that. Like, it's a hard question because it's like, I don't really care how people view me for me, but I do care for other people. So it's it really sets you up to like fail with the first one. It's like, yeah, I had like a nice, easy life. The third option should be that you had a very good impact. Like, it doesn't even specify your impact. It just says, like, you had a nice life. Like, yeah, you felt meaningful.
Yeah,
it's not, like, your impact on other people. Where I feel like there should be an option where it's, like, no, you had a, like, profound impact on other people. And then there's another caveat to that. Or, like, it was hard.
You just
maybe
forget.
That's the caveat. Where you're misunderstood in some way. Which is, like, that's fine. I'd rather be misunderstood than, like, slandered.
Yeah, I think, you know, in that context, I now have a different understanding of the Van Gogh episode of Doctor Who, and that if I die and then I'm remembered or I'm found to be some artist and people appreciate me, because sometimes people are like, oh, well, what's the good of that, right? Because that person doesn't benefit from it, but like my estate would. Like, if I leave and now like my children and my grandchildren get to inherit all of this like status, or like can live in relative ease because people have come around to appreciating something, then I, like me now, would much rather like be struggling through my life as it is, knowing that in the future there'll be, but that's a whole other conversation. Struggling now for future generations, that's just, not everybody gets that. Not everyone understands that is the key. We're supposed to be planting trees that we're never going to see grow to their full potential, but our children and their children's children will.
Yeah, and I think the issue with the question is that it's, you're revealed to be a talented artist whose reputation is assured, where it's like, I need my impact to be assured. Then I would definitely confidently choose the second one. You know, so if you pick the second one, though, you weren't alone. That's the moral of the story. That's apparently what most people pick, actually, when asked this question through the thought experiment.
Yeah, because I think like there's this understanding of like, oh, well, like, I think, yeah, just like, I think it hurts so much more if you're like twisted. Cause like you were saying, like the, all of those points that you're saying, like that we, that lead us to want to be remembered when we're dead, like Yeah. Every single one of those is tied to the fact that we're remembered in some positive way. Like, we want to make an impact. We want to stay around. Even if it's like our mundane, regular lives, we want them to be remembered in some way. Like, that just innately like exists in us, this desire. So of course we would pick that.
Yeah. And they even go on to say in this article that if this idea, that if most people want to be remembered in a positive way, if this was nurtured in the correct way, which currently it's like kind of an issue because you have it in a capitalistic lens where people misinterpret what positive is. And they're like, I'm just going to give my family all this money and no one else has money and we'll make dragons. I love that for us. Yeah, that's like, that's not. But if we're looking at it, if we nurture it in like a positive way where it could be used to leverage long-term global issues, as you were saying, plant trees we'll never see so that the generations in the future can fucking breathe. We could cure climate change and biodiversity and all these other things that the planet is on fire. We could stop it from being on fire and that'd be cool. I would love that for us. I'd love that. Not for us personally, but for our future.
For humans. Like the us.
The royal future of the planet. Not even just humans. I just want cool little cats and animals and other things to be living their safest, best life.
Yeah. 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 So I think that was great. That was a great question. You set me on fire. I didn't know I was going to be in a way that the show wasn't doing. So I'm thankful for that. And again, like the show itself was fine. I think there was some really great moments in it. I loved being able to see a queer relationship on screen and that they did get time together, even though it was a kill your gays trope. So they always got to die, right? I hate that.
Yep.
But this is a horror show, right? Yeah. So people
died. Knew going in that death was going to happen.
Yeah, people were not going to be happy. Although Hill House kind of teased out there was like a relative happiness. I think that's what it is. Is in all of them, it's never like a happy ending. It's just like we persevered. We're going to pick up. We're going to pick ourselves up and move on. Yeah. And we're going to be thankful that we're here kind of result, which is great. Yeah. You know, and I did really love, you know, those moments between Hannah and Owen, the few that we got, like they were so sweet. Mm-hmm. And I just love seeing Ravi. And
I look forward to seeing them again.
I love that this like ignited like Twitter and other places to really thirsting after him.
Because they should have been
like,
an
eye
zombie the whole time.
Yeah, I was like, he's hot. What are you talking about?
He's the cutest man
that I've ever. That's my sheriff. Yeah. They can't accept him. Like in one time. So next week we'll talk about midnight mass.
Yep.
I don't know why that took me forever. And then we'll close it out with the Fall of the House of Usher. So let us know what your favorite Mike Flanagan series is. We're obviously not covering them all and not all his movies and all of those things.
Let us know which scenario you want.
Yeah. Which one would you choose?
We'll let scenario this be one or two. A social discourse of use this as data. You know, it's science.
We'll contribute to it. Yeah. Let us know. You can send us an email. coolsnextdoor@gmail.com. Let us know your thoughts. And don't get married.
Don't eat your kids.
Or they possess your kids.
Yeah.
They just try to live in your kids' bodies.
But also, like, what do they get from that? Like, how do they actually leave, you know?
Because are they children didn't leave. Now? She couldn't leave.
Yeah. I know. That's what I'm saying. It's confusing. And also, it's like, are they going to still be in love as siblings? Because, ew.
That's gross. Yeah.
Yeah. And children. Well, because
I think that's the whole thing. Is like, he didn't want to. He doesn't care about her.
Yeah.
And I think it was more like, they're young, so they get to live a long time, even if they are stuck in this one place. Like, you don't get to do anything. Like, I don't want to live that hard. I don't want to live that hard. If I was a ghost and it was like, okay, you could inhabit and steal the life of this child or die, I would be like, death, please.
Yeah.
Take me to the lake. Take me to the lake. Yeah. It's you, it's me, it's none of us.
It's none of us, yeah. You're you, I'm me. Excellent. Love that for both of us. We aren't codependent. Codependence is a problem. Don't
never
do that.
Heard of her. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Well, bye.
Bye.